I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, David Noakes. Welcome, David.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, I'm really pleased you're here. Here we are in the west end of Fremantle, a place that's not entirely foreign to you. Tell our listeners why it's not foreign to you.
Well, I mean, there are plenty of people who think that I come from Western Australia in the sense that I was born here, but I wasn't. But in a way, I was born here. I came in 1976 to go to Murdoch University, and you know that really changed my life. And that university had a multidisciplinary approach, and it had, you know, it meant that you confronted history and politics and even science all in your first year, and it threw you into a whole lot of ways of thinking. And the milieu of people was quite significant because the average age was, you know, probably 30, because there were a lot of people who were a lot older because of the mature age entrance process they had. And I lived here until 93, and then I went to Sydney where I began working with the Film Finance Corporation in Sydney. But before that, I was here and making films after I graduated from Murdoch, and you know, heavily involved in the film community and exhibition, because I was involved in running a small cinema as well. So,
well, we're going to talk about the very, very particular reason you're back, a rerun in a sense, a re-showing of How the West Was Lost. A magnificent story. We'll get there. But did you come here to make films, or did that happen more in a more evolutionary way?
Film was absolutely my focus. When I was working in the bush off and on, and there I was in the bush, but I was reading, you know, books by Eisenstein, the Russian director and editor, and, you know, and I had my little Bolex, my 16mm Bolex, and I was shooting film, and I was already, you know, heavily involved in understanding how cinema worked. And I guess, yes, absolutely. And so I applied for the film component of at Murdoch University, the communication studies course. But when I got here, after a year or so, I realised that I was much more interested in politics and literature. And it was it then took me another 2.5-3 years where I digested a lot of that, and then I started to make a film, which was all about the Wagerup refinery that they were expanding and building that Alcoa was building, and we were making a film about the opposition and the non-violent occupation of that site. And so I guess that combined all of those interests into that film as an expression of where I was going.
When you look back, here we are in 2023. We've all got a little bit older than the mid-70s. And you look at what was happening with you around Fremantle, Western Australia in the film industry then. I'm assuming it was different from today. How would you describe what it was and how it's different?
Good question. The 70s saw the renaissance of Australian cinema, certainly in the feature film drama area, and documentary was there as well. I mean, documentary had a different... I mean, I also had an association before I came here with the Sydney Filmmakers Co-op. And, you know, people like Phil Noyce started at the Filmmakers Co-op, and they had a little cinema, and they showed the other part of the film industry, which is the experimental and the documentary and the counterculture films. And I guess I found myself more in that area than in the mainstream cinema area. But nonetheless, you know, it was so exciting to be there when at last we had a voice in Australia for fiction as well as non-fiction. And in the area of non-fiction, the major issue there was television wasn't showing what we were making. And they were while there were some, you know, certainly ABC was doing good things, but they weren't buying our films. They weren't. They thought our films weren't of their ilk. And, you know, you still had this sense of balance. You know, there had to be balance in everything. And so there was a long fight, really, to get independent cinema, as we called it, onto television screens. And that took a long time to really happen. And so, you know, for me, for, you know, Wager Up Weekend, which I made in 81, and then Millie O'Mara, Brand New Day, which I made in 83, and then even How the West Was Lost in 87, television wasn't interested in screening them. It just wasn't a possibility. But with How the West Was Lost, I eventually got them to take it, but I had to cut it down to a 55-minute film, which, you know, it's okay. But it's not the film that I made. But that was the beginning of the change, I think, where suddenly television was actually buying films from independent filmmakers. They were still wanting a certain stamp on it, but there is still a lot of cinema now, documentary cinema, which is not getting onto broadcasters. And people will sometimes do that same thing where they'll make a feature length and then they'll make a 55-minute version to go to TV. I think the other thing is it was just that simple sense of us having a voice and that, you know, an Australian voice and the characters, representation in the country and the city and Aboriginal Australia, you know, getting a voice. Although it was much slower to develop into a there were many more films obviously made about white stories. It was an exciting time, absolutely.
1987, How the West Was Lost, a period which is pre-Mabo, starting to see some land rights, but not in Western Australia, mainly in the Northern Territory through Commonwealth legislation. There'd been the 1967 referendum so that Aboriginal people could actually be counted when they tallied Australian population. But there was still a range of restrictive laws regarding native welfare. You make this film, and it wins awards.
Mm.
And it's a hell of a story that still, I suspect, many people don't know about. Mm. How did you become involved in it? And perhaps tell our listeners the kernel of the story.
Okay, well, it was interesting because I read about it when I was at Murdoch University, and it was like, I thought, man, this is amazing, incredible.
Someone should make a film about it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, exactly. I did think at that point, I thought, yeah, that'd be great to make a film about that. It was the story of how, you know, in the precy of it, which, you know, some people might argue about the numbers, but certainly the way it's spoken about is that 800 Aboriginal people, men, women and children, walked off the stations on the 1st of May 1946, and they had had enough. They'd had enough of not being paid or being paid very little, being fed very poor food they would describe as rotten meat in the wood heap, treated really appallingly on their own country. And to discover that there was this event happened in 1946, 20 years before Wave Hill, it's kind of like, wow, you know, like this is incredible. Why isn't that known? And then I think 2 years into my uni degree, I can't even remember which subject it was, they invited a guest, and it was Don McLeod, who was the white prospector who got befriended by the Aboriginal people in the area because he seemed to treat Aboriginal people reasonably, and they thought, oh, he's a good bloke. And so they started to ask him questions, you know, like, why is it that we can't leave the station, you know? How can we deal with this? Is there another way? So there was Don McLeod in my tutorial talking to us, and I just thought, incredible, you know, because he was such a strong, clear speaker. You know, there was no wavering of anything. And this is what we did, and this is why we did it. And, you know, and he was also a man of his era with his language. His language was much more from the 30s and the 40s. And that was very colourful too. So he's a very strong man that you felt like this man could never be corrupted. Some would say that he already was because he was such a, you know, a lefty, but he was really probably more of an anarchist in a way, because I think that he found it difficult to sit within the Communist Party structure, but that was certainly something that he felt more aligned to in terms of values. So, you know, I'd left university and I'd made a film about the opposition to the alumina refinery in Wagerup, and I'd made another film which was about an Aboriginal arts festival, and we invited a whole lot of Aboriginal people to come on the crew, and we trained them, and you know, so they would, we had a number of film crews, and so they were shooting some material, and then we had people in the edit room, and so it was an attempt by us to try and train Aboriginal people so they could actually make their own films, and that was part of our push. That film, you know, it's an important film because there's a lot of communities, Mojum community and the Turkey Creek mob, and who are featured in the film. And then what happened was the story that was happening within the Strelley community was that they were...
We're in the Pilbara. We're in the Pilbara.
Yeah. And they were... there was a guy there called Paul Roberts, who he was a teacher at the school. And the school had opened, I think, in 76. Before that, they had a school, but it wasn't properly supported by the government. And eventually they got their own school, and it was an independent school though, and they were teaching their own language as well as English, which was quite an advance. Anyway, they had, I think Don and Jacob Ubedu had talked to Paul about, you know, the idea of having a film about the strike had started to be talked about. They asked Paul to go and see what he could find, some people who could come and make a film about the strike. And it was funny because, you know, I remember sitting, as you say, in the tutorial, and there was Don speaking, and I was thinking, I'd love to make that film. I never thought that that would happen, you know. I just didn't think that was possible. And that was before I'd made Wagerup, I guess, and then I got a lot more confidence. But... So Paul came down to Perth, and he'd left Strelley by that point as a teacher, and he found Heather Williams, she was just really working hard, kicking goals. You know, she had already produced a couple of films, which was more in the area of ballet and the arts, and she had a short drama in process, in development, and she produced a film called A Little Life, which I can't remember the name of the young man, but he was shot by police. He's an Aboriginal guy, and he was shot by police escaping from jail. But it was one of those just terrible, sad stories that, you know, it just shouldn't have happened.
David, every time I see a movie or watch a documentary, I'm one of those who has to sit at the very end to read the credits.
Yeah.
And they roll on through. And so even the lawyers get acknowledged for giving along the way.
Yeah.
People who fed them.
Yeah.
But just on the technical side, the work that goes to make something creative like this seems, and no doubt is enormous. When it came to something like How the West was lost. How did you go about assembling everybody to produce the final cut?
What's interesting is that you look at the credits and you can see, I think the credits need to tell a story. And in How the West Was Lost, you know, there was Heather and I, and we were co-producers, and she was much more the producer in terms of, you know, raising the money and doing all of that correspondence. I was the producer much more in terms of realizing the film in terms of the paperwork to make sure that everything was okay that was in the film, and then I was also the director, so I actually was taking the final responsibility for the where the camera would be and et cetera, et cetera. But I have to say there was so much, the participation in this film in terms of where ideas came from and what we did was coming from all of us. And, you know, certainly Jacob Ubadu was the representative from the community. He, senior elder, and, you know, we wrote a script, which was, so we did a lot of research over about 4 or 5 weeks. So we went around and they took us everywhere, and we would do interviews, which would give us an understanding of what their story was. And then we wrote a script, which was pretty sketchy, but it would say, well, this story and in this place, and but it told the story. And we circulated that script and we talked about it. And when we came to film it, you know, we worked out when, in terms of a schedule, when we were going to shoot things, but Jacob and Crow and Snowy, they would kind of work out, okay, and they say, we're going here. So we'd get in the truck and off we'd go, three or four vehicles, and we'd go wherever we're going. And this is where we tell the story. And then they would come up with other ideas. So it wasn't being driven by, I want to tell the story here or there. It was much more about, this is where the story needs to be told, and this is what it relates to. And so we had dramatizations within it. And I always wanted to, one of the things that I wanted to do was to keep the integrity of them telling their story, but I also wanted to get some of that texture of dramatizing it, retelling it in real time with a group of people, which has a certain strength and authenticity about it. And that's what we did. There was a film that was made maybe 2 or 3 years before How the West Was Lost called Two Laws, which was made in the Burralula community in the Northern Territory. And that film was made where the filmmakers and the community worked out that they wanted to film it in a certain way. And so they used a wide angle lens and they would only film it that way. And they had a lot of dramatizations in the film. And what I felt about that was, I thought it was, and so it had a very kind of anthropological filmmaking approach to it, but I felt like it was less approachable for a general audience. So I wanted to try and get the feel of that authenticity of performance, which is, it's a kind of a informed performance where they're self-reflective of the process of telling the story as much as being the story. So that's the other thing that it gives it, is that this real life, that you get an insight into the culture because they're telling their story in an improvised way. So that were the kind of influences. So on the one hand, we had the community who were really active in working out where this story should be told in terms of location and sometimes how. And then we had DOP Phil Bull, who was fantastic. He was a West Australian who had already gone to Sydney, but he came back for the film. And, you know, he had a vision for the look of the film using some new red filters that had come out that would give it a certain look. And Paul Roberts was there as an associate producer, but as a co-writer. And Paul, you know, he had a very good knowledge of all of the community and the elders, was able to help and assist and always had really good ideas. And Paul went on after that to become a filmmaker and has made a lot of films.
Isn't it amazing from this experience? I mean, people will know or learn, and they should go to the screening on Friday night at Luna in Leaderville. But at 1st of May 1946, the strike starts, and you suddenly realise that's almost immediately after the end of the Second World War, in August 1945.
Yeah.
And these guys had been hatching this for a few years, talking to Don, and then kaboom, International Labor Day or whatever, May Day the 1st, out they go. And some time later, things get resolved one way and another. I mean, it's just a hell of a story. When you learnt more about the story and heard the participants talking about what they did and why, and were there parts of it that just took your breath away?
Yeah, look, I when I look back at it now, I'm even more incredulous that it's the bravery of these people, because they were putting, and when you look at the response by the Department of Native Affairs and the government, all of the correspondence, which, you know, we researched, it's like, you know, they were just outraged. They just couldn't believe that they were doing this. And of course, the pastoralists in those days were, you know, they were, a lot of them were in the government, you know, they had seats in the house. They were the main economic income was coming through agriculture and, you know, growing sheep, in this instance, growing wool. So I think the very idea of them walking away from the stations was, as all of the people in the Native Affairs said, well, they'll come back, they'll get hungry. But no, they didn't, because they actually had ways, you know, this is their country, they had ways to survive, whether it's, you know, bush meat, as they call it, kangaroo, or whether it's trapping rabbits, all sorts of, well, there was something else that
tastiest.
The honey and
all
bush
the,
honey.
All of the foods, all of the native foods. Bush turkeys, I found, are the very best.
Yeah. you know, they found a way to survive. It may not have been very comfortable, but they found a way to survive. And some of them would sometimes would go back to the station. But generally speaking, there was a big mob in two different camps, and they stayed out. And the most amazing story was when the police took Don McLeod and they put him into jail. And you know, a big mob from the 12 Mile out of Port Hedland, they came into town and they said, they've got Don in there. And they all walked on the police station. And I mean, you know, the way they tell the story is there were more people moving towards the police station than lived in the town. So it was pretty dramatic. And Don got let out. And they were after their ration coupons, actually. That's what they were after. And Don went in to argue for the ration coupons, because the ration coupons, after the Second World War, they were still rationing. And the ration coupons went to the station, and they were destined for these people, but the people weren't on the station, so they weren't getting their ration coupons. So Don was going to the police saying, they want their coupons, their coupons, not your coupons or the pastoralist coupons. And they didn't like, he was just being too noisy, and he was
white fella troublemaker.
That's right.
Member of the Communist Party to vote.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, like, it's incredible that, I mean, when we met Don, and you know, there's no flicker of anything from Don except for the hard line, and I'm sure there's obviously a lot more there, but it's that's, you know, Don, he's a hard man in that respect, but he knows that, you know, the way that he's worked is in order to get where he's got to, which is, you know, a group of people who became self-sufficient, was really because he was because of that hard line that he took.
And Strelley became the proof of that pudding, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And Strelley, Warralong, Lala Rook, and there's another station. You know, they ended up with three or four stations. I mean, look, it's still hard, because you know, those people are not, they didn't choose to live where they are. They'd much rather be, you know, I mean, it's that terrible thing of post-colonialism where what was is disrupted, and no longer works in the same way, and the future doesn't recognise a whole lot of things of that culture. So they're kind of, they're still in a difficult place, and I think it's always in transition. You know, it'll probably get to a stasis, I hope. But yeah, it's not easy out there on any of these stations. But I think having more ability to self-determine is really the only way to go.
When the film was made, How the West Was Lost, what's your recollection of the immediate reactions at whatever levels, critical, popular?
It got into the Festival of Perth, which was a big surprise, and that was fantastic because that's exactly where we wanted it. Because for me, the Festival of Perth back then was a very conservative organisation, and you know, it was that thing about there's politics and there's politics, or there's theatre and there's politics. And I remember that because I was in I had a small period of my time when I was in Desperate Measures, which was a street theatre company. And I remember, you know, someone on the ABC making that comment. It's like, well, you know, you're not meant to mix the two. You know, it's meant to be, you know, one or the other. And I think the Festival of Perth certainly sat in that place where they didn't want to have anything that was controversial. So I was really pleased that they chose to take it, and it, you know, ran for the usual 1 week and mostly full houses, which was fantastic. And it was but you know, I was thinking back to it, and I was thinking, isn't that odd how now at a film festival you have a film like this, and you know, they'll expect that the members of the community will be there, and there'll be speeches and engagement. None of that happened. And it was really odd. I mean, we went, when the first print of the film was struck, we then took it with a projector and a screen, and we flew up to Port Hedland, and we had a fantastic meeting in a creek bed, put up the screen, put the projector up, had a generator out the back, and everyone sat down and watched it. And it was fantastic. It was great. It was a great night. And so that was the world premiere in a creek bed. It's interesting because, you know, the film tells the story in a European way with, you know, a great homage to Aboriginal storytelling, but it can never be an Aboriginal film in that sense. But it certainly tries to engage on both levels of storytelling. And it also tries to tell a very big story, which, you know, it's telling the story from when the first flag went up in 1829, and as a context for where these people found themselves. But it was, you know, and it's screened throughout Victoria and New South Wales, and so, you know, it got good exposure, and every time it screened there was a great response. I was disappointed that television didn't want to take it straight away. Channel 4 in the UK, they wanted it at the original length. They could see its value and its strength. And I think when I think about, I mean, but nonetheless, it wasn't a conventional documentary. It's not a conventional film. It's telling a film the way it tells its story is as much as anything about the story. To try and get across without, you know, a directed narration. The narration is there simply to record the facts. And then the story tells itself, or the people tell the story. So it's that juxtaposition between the traditional documentary and a documentary which is telling a story which is much more about dramatisation.
Well, it won awards.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And all false modesty aside, why did it win those awards?
Oh, I think it was unusual, absolutely, and I think it was strong. And I think, you know, everyone did a magnificent job. You know, like I worked with Frank Rijovec, who also is a very experienced West Australian filmmaker now. He was the editor. And I think, you know, this was, Frank was, you know, someone who was in a place where he was ready to, you know, really do something big. And so it was an absolute joy to work with Frank. And Frank and I worked together crafting the film. How were we going to weave this material together to tell this story? On the one hand, there's chronology, but on the other hand, there's history which needs to be in there in order to create a context. So sometimes you have to go backwards and forwards. The other thing is that the archival footage we found was pretty amazing. There's some incredible footage of Aboriginal people working on the station. And it's home movie footage shot by the pastoralists. And it's this beautiful Kodachrome 16mm, their home movies that they would have been shooting. And it, you know, there's one particular scene where there's two women with two white children, and they're holding their hands and they're walking towards the camera. And there's this moment where the white girl looks up to the Aboriginal woman, and the Aboriginal woman looks down to her, and there's this big smile between them. And that kind of says so much. It says, you know, here were these people who loved the children of the pastoralists and looked after them, and they entrusted them with that relationship. Yet they treated them so poorly, and there was a kind of a failure to understand their culture. Like, I think it's, you know, there's a blindness there. And, you know, part of it's about the fact, I guess, that they just had a certain perspective and they couldn't see the world in any other way. Because I'm sure in the day, if you met them, you'd think they were reasonable human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Yet for them, it was acceptable to do what they did. But for Don, it wasn't. So it's an interesting conundrum, and you know, because I don't think you know, there's, we know in Western Australia there's plenty of street signs out there which have the names of all of many of those families who ran those stations and were highly respected people, yet they responded to the Aboriginal people that were on their station in this particular way. It's a interesting conundrum. Anyway, the archival footage, the way it was able to show up those relationships was stunning, and it was amazing. So all of those things combined together to then create something which just sang. And I think the other thing is that this story just needed to be told.
Mm-hmm.
And the story had power. You know, and talking to these men and women, you know, the women, because the women were doing the work inside, they were the ones looking after the kids, and they speak in the film. You know, we made sure that their voices were there, and they all, for them to do what they did was incredibly brave. But I guess they were in that place where it had to stop, and they needed to do something.
When the audience comes along Friday night, what are they going to experience? What do you want them to experience?
Oh, I think I want them to just to be able to experience those men and women on the screen, and think about, see, feel what a huge thing it was for them to do. And that's why we weave the Department of Native Affairs material in between it, so that to create a sense of what was happening down there in Perth and the response, because you can't really measure that. And there, you know, it was, and we didn't seek to talk to any pastoralists. Felt like that wasn't the way to tell the story. The story was about the strikers, but we needed to find a way to help the audience understand what was happening on the ground. And in a way, the correspondence expresses that quite well. the way in which, you know, they're reporting back how they've arrested X and Y and how they need to get Dooley and Clancy because they're causing too much trouble. And so that weaving between then creates a sense of what you imagine you can't see on the screen, but was there for them every day. The sort of the state exerting itself on these people.
I'll just manoeuvre you a little. We started mentioning where we were in Fremantle. I think you spent some time at FTI here.
I did, yeah.
Film and television.
Yeah. Now that was a... Where I started with FTI was when it was PIFT, and
yes.
And I went there as a consumer of film, because the National Film Theatre was screened there Monday and Tuesday nights, magnificent cinema of the world, and we would go there, and then I started talking to the people who ran the NFT, and they, you know, we started becoming friends. And And then I wondered, well, what goes on in here, this other than showing films? And I discovered that, you know, they were making films there, and they're shorts, and they had a relationship with Curtin University. And of course, I was political, you know, and, you know, I was a little bit disappointed that they weren't making any films which had any political content, drama or documentary. And so that became my big rubric, really, at what was then PIFT, was that there's money available to make films from the Australian Film Commission, yet no one's getting any money here. Why is that? And so we started to, you know, rattle the chain a little bit and say, well, this organisation should be helping people. And at the same time, I started making Wager Up Weekend, and we started to apply to the Film Commission. And you know, because we were the only people applying, they'd put us on a plane and fly us over there rather than fly over here, which was, you know, kind of terrible, because, you know, at least if they came here, they would start interacting with other people, and that might start a bit more of an avalanche. But, you know, long story short, you know, PIFT almost went bankrupt. And one of the reasons why that happened was because it became so overtaken by people who were wanting to make television series, which in itself is a great thing. But the downside was that a non-profit organisation was used as a springboard, and they really sapped the resources and the money, and it was ended up being, you know, and so the TV series became of more importance, and the organisation was, you know, staff positions were really working on this TV series, not in the organisation. And so then they had to employ more people. And then, of course, they didn't have the money. And then, you know, it was $150,000 in debt. And that was when I came in and I became a board member. So I was a board member, and I was trying to change things to make the organisation much more about supporting filmmakers in general rather than just one or two in particular. And then at the same time, Free Video, which was another non-profit organisation in Fremantle, the two organisations had to amalgamate because the Film Commission wasn't going to fund both of them. There was an amalgamation, and that way, and then the old FTI, sorry, the old PIFT, the old PIFT and its funny constitution, which said that, you know, most board members were elected by the existing board members. I think there was two that were voted on from the floor. So it was a bit of a closed shop, as Don McLeod would say, a bit of a cabal. FTI was created, and after a lot of angst between all the parties, and that organisation had a democratic board, and it moved forward, and suddenly we started to see filmmakers applying for money and making their own films as distinct from the previous era, which, you know, the previous era, those people who made the TV series, they did create a lot of good skill and Steve Jodrell, great director, and Steve did make a film with money from the Film Commission, and Steve made some really good work. And so there was, you know, highly skilled people that were developed through that process, but it didn't really allow other people to come in. So the new era started at FTI, and I became the chair of the board, and I think I did that for 3 years, but I found it, you know, it was very hard to do that as well as make films, and so eventually I passed the baton on.
It certainly sounds like a highly administrative, executive.
Political.
And political in every sense, yeah. Capital P and little p.
Yeah.
So what did you do after that? Apart from the filmmaking?
Well, how do you mean?
Well, I think you found your way back to the East.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, what happened was, you know, look, we made How the West Was Lost. I think I looked it up the other day. I think we had in the wages line, we had $6,000, but we only got paid two, and there was $4,000, which was deferred. So that was subject to profit. And after How the West Was Lost was made, I was completely broke because I'd earned next to nothing. And so I got offered a position at the Film Commission in Melbourne. So I thought, oh, great, I'm actually going to get a paid job. That's fantastic. So I went off to Melbourne to do that job. And at the same time, I was just doing the final finishing touches of the film, because we still had to create a film with subtitles and all the final work that has to be done at that point. And then so I finished the film, and I was working for the Film Commission, and but you know, I wanted to come back, and I was there. I think I was at the Film Commission for maybe 18 months. And during that time, you know, the film sold to Channel 4. And sold to the ABC, and the theatrical release made money as well. And so out of that, we paid out all of the deferrals, which included money back to the community. And I think there was deferrals and a little bit more, which was great. So everyone saw some money, which was fantastic. And then I applied for a documentary fellowship, which was... They'd started this about maybe in the mid-80s, where every year there would be two filmmakers that would get a fellowship, and the fellowship would be an amount of money from the Film Commission and an amount of money from the ABC, and you could make any film you like. And so you didn't have to apply for a particular film with a script, you would just get a lump of money. And I was lucky enough, I got one of the two in 1988, I think, on the strength certainly of How the West Was Lost. That was, you know, that was the response from the assessors. So I was really chuffed, and I came back to WA to make the film that I wanted to make, which was originally, in my mind, was called Ghosts That Never Die. And it was really about the idea that history lives in the present. You just have to look for it, and it's there, staring you in the face, whether it be street signs or the way people respond, or WA Foundation Day, which was a good example in the final film that I made, which I ended up calling Bigger Than Texas. And the reason I called it Bigger Than Texas was because after I finished Wager Up Weekend, the head of the WA Film Council invited me to breakfast, and it was a pretty conservative organisation. And I was, you know, a bit surprised. So I went off to breakfast. That wasn't really something we did then. I went to breakfast, and the CEO was saying to me, well, you know, maybe you could make a film, you know, about Western Australia, you know, because it's a lot of interesting facts. Like, you know, it's bigger than Texas. And so I thought that was, you know, it was like, what he was really saying is, can you not make something about politics? Could you make something, you know, about, some facts which...
Fuel companies.
Yes, that's right. And something that's going to attract people here, you know, tourists. It'll be, put us on the map in a good way.
South Beach, South Fremantle.
That's right.
So you made this film.
Well, I made it, but it was, yeah. I came back, and that was my fellowship film. I found it a very hard film to make. It was funny, you know, precisely because you were given the money with no script. Suddenly, you kind of, oh, I could do anything, but, you know, what will I do? And it's quite difficult.
Yeah.
And then I had this idea, which was reasonably abstract, and then trying to turn it into reality. And my original idea was always, you know, by filming actual events, and the way you film it and the way you observe it allows the audience to see into the cracks and see the history seeping out. And that's kind of what I did. You know, like, for instance, there's a juxtaposition near the end where a mob of blackfellas from the Swan River area are pegging out where the graves are on Rottnest. And that's intercut with some MPs who are planting trees in this other area, which is a new a reclaimed land area. It's kind of like each part of the history are trying to leave their marks on the land as a way of expressing their belief in the side of history that they're on. Equally a skirmish, which I went and filmed a Foundation Day, as we used to call it, event where a woman was singing songs about Western Australia, and there was a lot of audience. I can't remember what it was, some sort of organisation about Western Australia. And I just happened to be filming it, and suddenly this man, an Aboriginal man, arrived with a flag and a loud hailer and started saying, yeah, well, that's, what about the massacres? What about this? And it was like, oh, okay.
Well, so, timed.
Yeah, absolutely. I had no idea that was going to happen, and that has a particular place. And then, of course, we go in, they all go inside, and we go inside and we film this young woman singing this song about this very idealised idea of Western Australia. So non-problematic place. And I think, so it's quite a strong piece.
So in terms of your own career, you've kept making films.
Well, I think for me, when I came back and I made that film, and then after that, it was again that struggle of, trying to survive and make the films that I wanted to make. And I got offered a position back in Sydney as a investment manager in the new organisation called the Film Finance Corporation. And that started a whole new world for me, in that the Film Finance Corporation was all about trying to put your films into markets and trying to help people to try and make a business out of making films. And so it was much more about marketplace attachment, so getting advances from the territories that were interested in your film, so that when you got government money, you got less government money because you've got government money. You got money from broadcasters and distributors and sales agents. So for the first time, I was really engaged in that area, which I didn't really know much about. And so I would travel to Europe twice a year and go to the markets, and suddenly I was learning about the world of finance for cinema. And
which is fascinating, no doubt, and it's in its own way, because without it, a whole variety of films won't be made. There are still young people like you were when you arrived here all those years ago, making shorts, making documentaries, but then want careers. And of course, film making gets talked of incessantly. Even here in Fremantle, there was a proposal for a new film studio on Victoria Quay, which is now happening out in Malaga. But as we get towards the end of this discussion, particularly about film, where is Australian filmmaking, whether it's shorts, docos, feature films, television included, where is it? And we've, of course, had all of this streaming filmmaking going on during COVID and beyond. How do you, as you look forward now, all in?
After I worked at the Film Finance Corporation, then I went and I produced some television for a little while. And then I worked for the National Film and Sound Archive, and I did restorations on Sentimental Bloke and Waking Fright. And then I went, and at that point I was thinking, what am I going to do now? And a friend of mine who I'd met through the Film Finance Corporation, she was a producer, and she had taken over a business which was a completion guarantor. And I went and I was talking to her, and she said, well, why don't you join us? And so I became a completion guarantor, which is a very, you know, at the other end of the spectrum, where I look after, I mean, I guess since that time I've looked after hundreds of films, and you know, we guarantee that they get finished and delivered. And that gives you a very good perspective of what's being made in this country and in New Zealand. And I guess, you know, I think, you know, television is in a bit of a prime spot now, in that there's a lot of demand for it, and the streamers are part of that, without a doubt. And I think there's been a lot of change, because theatrical distribution came under a lot of pressure, and getting people to the cinema is much harder now. I think Australian film is still incredibly strong, where, you know, and I think Indigenous filmmaking is the strength of it. I have to say, I think Indigenous filmmakers make great films because they've got stories to tell, very strong stories. They have witnessed, either directly or through their family or their friends, very highly dramatic situations, and that gives them an appreciation. But it also of drama. But it also there's also a lot that they have to say. You know, The New Boy is a classic example of that. And
yes,
and when I saw The New Boy at the Sydney Film Festival, you know, there were some friends of mine, Aboriginal friends of mine, just over the way, and it was what was the most fantastic thing was to hear they would laugh at things that I didn't really know why they were laughing, but because they knew that what the actor was doing there, that reminded them of something that I hadn't experienced, but they had.
And so, Warwick Thornton had.
Yeah, and you know, so there was a multi-levels going on there. And then Warwick's ability with genre is just phenomenal. You know, his ability to understand and then to take the genre and bend it again is fantastic. So I think that's the most exciting thing in Australian cinema at the moment. I think the Australian industry has some really good, strong connections internationally. And so we're seeing, you know, some big budget films being made, allowing people to realise big stories, which is fantastic. And that's really come about because of the certainly the work, I think, of the Film Finance Corporation. I think it was significant work where introduction between filmmakers and bankers, for want of a better word, or distributors, sales agents, where there's some real money, and those people could realise that this film could make money, because that's what it's about, really, for that commercial cinema side. The streaming side, it's complex. You know, the streamers, I don't think, yet really appreciate the fact that a national story can translate to an international film. I think they still want to make American films in Australia more often than not. And having a quota of investment from streamers in Australia, I think, is an essential element. That will mean that they'll actually then have to really back Australian films that they will then need to push out there into the international marketplace. I mean, yes, there'll be some Australian films that they will put money into that'll only work in Australia. But, you know, you have to make, you know, 10 or 20 films in order to get five that really work. And that's the economy of all film industries, really.
So, to finish off, it sounds like you're optimistic about all those things.
Look, I think certainly with the new government, I think with streamer quotas coming in, I think that's great. I think, financing with the producer offset legislation which came in 2009, I think, that just has changed things as well. And that's still there. That hasn't, I mean, the Liberals were going to get rid of it or dilute it, but that got pushed out, even under their government by the Senate. So I think that, that things are, I mean, look, it's always tough. Everyone wants more money. but we know there's a lot of things that need money in our economy, so we have to be careful. But yeah, no, I think certainly, and Indigenous filmmaking, I think, is the most wonderful thing in our industry today.
David Noakes, it's been fascinating talking to you. Welcome home to Fremantle.
Thank you.
Good luck on Friday night.
Yeah, thank you.
And with everything else you're doing.